Pat and I met about 27 years ago through his wife, Joanna, and my partner, Judy Walcott, who had grown up together on the North Shore. On our first evening in their Essex home, I was immediately attracted to Kent's library. I think I spent more time examining his extensive collection of new American poetry than I did socializing with the other dinner guests. Naturally, my eyes first lighted on his books by Charles Olson, not the editions published after the poet's death in 1970, but the earlier Jargon Corinth Maximus, among others. Kent had come early to Olson, just as while a student at Berkeley, he had come to know the poets of the San Francisco Renaissance of the mid and late 1950s, Robert Duncan, Jack Spicer, Robin Blazer. Kent attended readings at Berkeley. He roamed the aisles of the great Berkeley and San Francisco bookstores, and he regarded Spicer, Blazer, and Duncan as his mentors. Of these important years, Kent writes, "I attended poetry workshops run by Rex Roth and Duncan. I read a lot. I learned to write by writing a novel. The novel was good enough that a prof in the English department had me send it to an agent in New York. I was also politically active, organized the first student workers' union at UC, took off-campus courses in Marxist ideology, canned that, became aligned with the Trotskyites and anarchists, helped set up the first student workers' picket line in Berkeley. One group, Spicer and myself, Jim Herndon, lost control of the union when the Young Communist League packed the house and took over." Spicer was really the most helpful mentor. He led me to books to read. Also, Bob Berg, manager of the major bookstore and later head librarian at San Francisco State. "I'm totally," Kent says, "an autodidact." During those years of literary and political ferment, Jonathan Bayliss, author of the Gloucester Man novels, was also a student at Berkeley, majoring in English, though he and Kent did not meet until many years later in Gloucester. Jonathan left the university to become a writer and business analyst. Kent became a physicist, working mainly in optics, and later, as he writes, as a self-employed consultant. Yet, like most scientists, Kent had a mind that ranged widely over literature and the arts. You won't be surprised to learn that Kent is also a painter, which he has been doing for 50 years. Kent can tell you more about those extraordinary years in the Bay Area, including a fascinating history of his family in Utah and San Francisco, where he actually grew up. What I can say by way of introduction is that although Catharsis, Sifting Through a Mormon Past, is Kent's first published book, he has been writing poetry of great depth, maturity, and high lyricism for many years, and has most recently been posting it on his website, Poetry and Images. In these turbulent times, we need what William Carlos Williams called the news that poetry brings, for the lack of which people die. We will have some of that news tonight from Kent, and I'm happy to introduce him to you.
Kent, excuse me, I hate to make this, have to do this right now, but there's a car parked in the Richdale. It's parked the wrong way. It's a blue Prius.
Oh, that's me, I think.
Oh, that's you. I'm actually at...
If you can move it and maybe move it over there, then there won't be a... It's going the wrong way.
Okay.
Want to lower the mic?
Yes. Thank you.
Let's see, move this a little closer. I just had cataract surgery, so I'd have to use glasses, but sometimes need some light. Well, Catharsis, I chose to use a K instead of the customary C, because I wanted to use the Greek meaning of cleaning the soul, not the kind of catharsis you think of as belonging to a play when you revealed everything, but this more restricted sense. And to more or less describe that in this context, I have the poem on the back of the cover. After a child learns to see and walk, it's why. Why is the grass green, the moon yellow, then white? What's good, what's bad? You're big, they're small. They believe, they invent. And they want you to tell them how Santa Claus is, and everything you say goes inside where neurons form forever. The true and the untrue alike, the moral and immoral, they see. All the viruses of belief get stuck inside, and it's hell to get them out. Mm-hmm. So this is about getting them out. I think I'll just start at the beginning, the introduction. When my mother was in her late 80s, she wrote a family history for me. Some of the following narrative is taken from that work, including some quotes attributed to the elders. I've chosen a small portion about my grandfather, Chris Sorensen, and his parents to cast light on the Mormon religion, how it affected my family, and how it may influence the lives of many other families. I am no longer a Mormon. I rejected it when I was 16, actually 15, but the early exposure to it is still part of me, like it or not. My mother describes her wedding to my father in the Latter-day Saint Temple in Salt Lake City as the first of many disillusioning experiences that ultimately led her to abandon the church and recognize the validity of her father's negative feelings. Chris Sorensen was an agnostic farmer who patiently acquired and cultivated a large farm. He lived plunk in the center of Utah, in Centerfield, just south of Gunnison, possibly the most conservative area in the state. When he prospered, he built a large Victorian house across the street from the old Adobe Mormon Church, presently a state monument. And that Mormon church is on the cover of the book, but this was taken in 1956 when I drove through. And since then, it's been cleaned up, polished, memorialized, and so on. Chris would have little to do with the Mormon church, as he could, and live in a town comfortably. He was popular with Mormon farmers because he brewed beer and would share it with those who helped him, even though Mormons were forbidden booze, coffee, and tea. When my mother, Ramona Amber Sorensen, was about 10, supported by her sympathetic mother, Elizabeth, she defied her father and baptized into the church because she wanted to be closer to her friends. When she graduated from the University of Utah, she married my father, John Lyman Boker, the son of a Mormon bishop in Groveland and Blackfoot, Idaho. The following narratives and poems are about my family's interaction with the Mormons. To a greater extent, they're about the Mormons, their beliefs, their control over almost everyone in Utah and Idaho, and the effects of theocracy that persist even now. Book two contains a few poems about the Mormon religion and practices and about the high plateau of the West where the Mormons settled and founded their Zion, and where most of them still live. The poems reflect a childhood immersed in Mormonism, as well as my sense of the arid West, garnered from many trips to New Mexico and adjacent states. The Mormons settled near the lands of the ancient Anasazi, where they have prospered because the last few centuries have been relatively wet. This is beginning to change with global warming as drought becomes extensive and mountaintops burn. The Chicoan culture, centered just south of Utah, flourished for 400 years, collapsing almost 1,000 years ago when a severe 50-year drought wiped it out. This event may unfortunately be the template for the future. I'm very grateful to my mother at 89, nearly blind and living alone in her house to the city, made the great effort to give me her history. Without it, I would not have ventured this work. Okay. The prologue. My mother destroyed her novel a long time ago. My memory is cluttered with images of sagebrush, tumbleweed on fences, and dead acid white soil. Up in the hills was a dry farm that was part of the land my great-grandfather owned. It had pockets of hard pan, little dry lakes between the rills, surfaces crazed by cracked light tan hexagons and squares. In the grooves between these blocks, there always seemed to be the darkness of water-touched clay. Although I never saw her novel, I can imagine it through the lens of my memories and piece something together, like those polygons trying to view it through the cracks of my mother's austerity and denial. I was living in Berkeley when she destroyed her novel. She never talked about it unless asked, and even then would brush off the attention as quickly as she could. She wrote during the Depression, all the time I was growing up, it seemed. I remember her writing a lot of stories that got rejected by the obscure journals like the Farmers Weekly or Grange News. She once ventured to send one to the Ladies' Home Journal. I never knew where she sent the novel, if she ever did. She kept it in the boxes the paper came in. She typed it in one of those monstrous old black Underwood typewriters with the flying keys that get tangled together when you strike two of them at the same time. I don't remember her writing when she lived in San Francisco in one of those dismal gray-white stucco flats out in the avenues near the ocean in persistent fog. She seemed to be writing whenever I did something wrong, like fighting with my brother Wayne, because the tension in the house was so great. Angered when my father came home, she turned me over for beating. Like most other people at the time, they thought that corporal punishment was good for building character and obedience. She had stopped believing in the Mormon religion, but my father felt that it was his duty to send us to church, and she acquiesced. For a while they went with us, but she felt the hypocrisy in their public testimonials. Eventually, she prevailed, and they stopped going. However, my brother and I were made to go till we got old enough to stop. It made an atheist out of me and a Christian Scientist out of him. When I think about Mormons now, I think of the dry lakes on that farm, seeing my mother's novel through the cracks. I have big blanks in my memory of childhood. I think my mother may have started writing when we lived on the farm in Utah, while my absent father in San Francisco looked for work. I remember seeing shooting stars in the brilliant Milky Way when I was 4 and a half. As my uncle drove me and my shattered arm to Salt Lake City for repair, I had fallen off a cow. I was a solitary child because we were Mormons who didn't mix with other Mormons. And we're not included in other sects. We had no social life. I drifted, daydreamed. I remember bubblegum cards, war, cards of dismembered soldiers and children, Spanish, Chinese, bombing raids by black Stukas, women running in Shanghai with red bursting paws like colored mud splats, ripping buildings about them, and bare steel girders sticking up through flower-like fire, Japs with bayonets, sticking people with red and yellow rising sun images behind them. I remember trading these cards with a friend one day when the typewriter banged furiously in the other room, noisier than usual, because I had a friend in the house. We'd rushed in because I had a Mukden bridge card. I think a goodie he wanted, and vice versa. I didn't carry my goodies with me because I'd lose them if I was caught by the local gang. So I had to come home to get it from the place. I hid it so my brother wouldn't find it. That was all right with my mother, but I bought in a friend, and that wasn't. I never had friends in the house except for a birthday party. We left quickly, and the typing didn't stop, and I felt it was like scolding rat-a-tat-tat at my back. I'd expected her to stop, but she never did type when I was near, just stood by doing something, chore-like, picking things up or putting them down. I don't remember my parents having anybody in either, except for my father's sisters and their families on holidays. There were just four of us. But for a while, my cousin Carol, whose mother had to work because her husband had been run over by a train in Idaho, but she didn't stay long. My mother was very thin, very tense, and even in her 30s, was beginning to develop vertical furrows in her brow that marked an anger and pain I always had felt directed at me or our existence. Her fragile beauty was being drained in sewing, mending, dishes cleaning, cooking overdone meat and potatoes when we had any money, or beans when we didn't. She never asked for help, never demanded that we clean our room. My father set the rules, gave us our chores, as if we had to do the chores, cows at 5 in the morning. She wrapped herself in an old cotton apron, colors faded long before, and did her chores. We were sick a lot. My brother had TB. My cousin had TB. Wayne and I, mumps, chicken pox, all the childhood diseases at one time, it seemed. Wayne also had a cleft palate that he had to have fixed. And we were always going to UC Medical, walking, or sometimes taking the streetcar up the hill on the other side of the park. There wasn't any money. We were always waiting for in the clinic. There were clinics for the poor then. My father had a job, but like everyone else, he didn't get much more than the minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. Our flat was cheap, the top of the rise on a streetcar street. There would be straining sounds as the monsters groaned their way up and brakes squealing as they clattered down all day long and into the night. I don't know where my mother could have written or how she could have thought clearly through the metallic grinding screech of the machines outside. They dressed up on Sundays, my father in his heart shaftered Mark suit, my mother in her homemade dresses. Socks always rode down into my shoes, and the darning patches on my heel hurt. My father always wore a thin-brimmed Stetson in a dull conservative color, handkerchief and breast pocket. He looked staunch and dapper. My mother, thin and worried, but in a simple navy blue suit with white ruffles and collar she had made herself using the thin paper pattern she bought at the pattern store on Market Street or on Clement Street next to the movie house. Paper is pinned to the cloth for cutting. She showed us, sewed us into respectability to go to church or to school. She was a superb seamstress, carefully lining impeccably tailored jackets and pants. But the clothes didn't look like the cheap, store-bought clothes the other kids had. So then we have, it's divided into two books. What is the narrative, basically, of the family, the beginnings in Denmark and on through to the present? And so the other book is the poetry that accompanies it. So I'll read from the first, book one, my mother's novel. San Francisco, 1930s. The city streets smell of the fog-drenched sea. Streetcars outside rage up and down Balboa Street, banging out of the muffled air and vanishing quickly, leaving the clacking of typewriter keys, remainders of life in the oppressive silence. She writes her novel day after day, remembering the saga of her life up till then, before the depression years of want and hunger, and a stultifying marriage with two sons. At night, her husband reads Zane Grey, plays solitaire. There's not much to say. The Mormon heritage haunts her. Her husband hides from them. They go to the local Mormon church, but don't mix. There are ghettos in this San Francisco, blacks in the Fillmore, cordoned off Chinatown, Italians in North Beach, Jews in the neighborhoods, Okina's Arkies arriving from the dust lands, striking longshoremen tenting by the docks. Her family is outside the social circles, among the low bourgeois in stuccoed wrecks of flimsy frame houses, cheaply crushed against each other, property too dear for amenities. There is loneliness but hope. So she writes her novel, cutting out time from the children, hoping to get them, get her out. Her horizon is low, expectations less. Rejections from Grange magazines don't help. She sews all their clothing, mends, steals time off, keeps the house tidy, can't keep the ants out or the mold in the big bug, in the fog-ridden, paint-peeling, gray, tireless city avenues near the ocean. It's digging time for her within her, the history, the forgotten rising up uncomfortably, a writer's brisk task, truth. If asked, never mind, she'd say, the swallowed pain of a stoic, her face unrevealing, inside angered thoughts, disappointment, enduring it. The fruit of their union, brief as it was, squabbling on the kitchen floor, two whiny, needy, willowy boys binding her chains. The blank stare in photographs from this time, direct, expressionless, waiting for the moment to go away, waiting to get back to work. In Denmark, 1850s. Landscapes get inside our young bones, stay for generations. Memories of ancient homes, harsh climes, hard men and women, unyielding to the soft and safe and the dreams that open hearts. The waves of the Sacharach shift sands up and down the Bay of Woe, jammerbocked. Damp fog wraps the white thatched cottages scattered over a desolate heathland with weak, sandy soil, insufficient for large families. An uninheriting youth go west or south, like San Francisco sand dunes, an unrelenting sea and fog in our bones, our origin. Having gone south, Christian Peter Sorensen, a handsome, rough youth, became a carpenter. He worked first on a mill in North Schleswig, but having to escape conscription and a possible war, found a job near Gdansk building a windmill for Maria Mikkelsen's father. He met her, saw her briefly. Her father disapproved of her mixing with the help. Finished, he moved on to Copenhagen. She grew up in a mansion not unlike Egeskov, with a moat and towers, herb gardens, peacocks, and a flowered maze, but felt her life stifled there and fled to Copenhagen, where she met Peter again and fell in love. Houses with small windows protect and confine everywhere in Denmark. Winter is long and hard, where everyone turns inside, endures the dark, while reigning ministers evoke God and virtue. All to be forgotten on Midsummer's Day. This how I imagine her novel begins. Flowers, youth blossoming, children in love, Copenhagen's ring of parks and the new Tivoli, long summer nights of paradise. Often they had nowhere to stay, but they found friends, found the Mormons welcoming the wandering flower children, the aimless Copenhagen hippies of 1830s, giving the disaffected and the spiritually empty shelter, warmth, and a message. 1856, excuse me. New love is thin, fragile. We wrap ourselves in the other, vulnerable for promises and religion's drug. Maria, just 17, accepted the new faith, accepted the ideals of a blissful life here and in the beyond, accepted the Mormon belief in revelation and oneness with God, and with Peter's agreement, accepted baptism into the flock. She went with two white-clad figures into the shallow Sum at the edge of Copenhagen's West Wood, inside a ring of Danes preaching to converts, standing in water up to their waists. The elders placed their hands on her head, pressed her down into the water to feign drowning, chanting prayers over her fear, sounds that blasted the agony of impending death until at that fearful edge, deliverance. Gasping for air, gasping in resurrection, love for the elders bringing her back, affirming the absolute religious pledge, belief in the angel Moroni and the divinity of Mormon prophets. Pressure, heavy hands, holding breath, empty fear, listening to the last words you fear you will ever hear, then salvation, and you belong to those who give you life. I might as well get all the way to the end of this section. Now they plan escape and future happiness, release from prohibitions together in love. It seemed the baptism was just something they did while they frolicked in the city, happy to play in the new Tivoli Gardens, the grandest enjoyment in all Denmark, for they were simple and adoring each other without nothing else was important. When the departure to America came near, she told her family in Gdansk, and her father disowned her, telling her to return only when she denounced the Mormons. He allowed her a pittance, her clothing, and a mattress filled with coins, dried mushrooms, and flower seeds, remnants of her old life. This meager dowry, they sailed away to be married on board. They had one night together in the missionary's relatively luxurious cabin. Then they went to segregated dorms, their passions discontent. With more words than these in her novel, she reimagined history, began as love's need, set the innumerable fate, the crack in the foundation that would persist through generations, between those who would and would not baptize into the skewed Mormon fundamentalism, a curse of being neither in or out. We see the past backwards, not as it was seen then, one step after another. We see from where it got to. Can't get out of our minds into the reality of stepping, seeing the rocks entangled, roots underfoot. Romantic imagination doesn't look at the ticks, indecision between storyline and reflection, plodding along safely, or the other, contradicting, embarrassing. Peter and Maria clung together as they could, both when they could both be together on deck during the long sail to America across adverse seas, winds with seasick, vomit, boredom, and doubt, with Lutheran mares mixed in with Mormon plain song and endless appeals to God. She was held up by the weight of hands holding her underwater and her deliverance. He was built to endure the aching stoic. The LV Hint sailed from Copenhagen April 18, 1857, to Liverpool. The HMS Westmoreland sailed April 13th to Philadelphia, Iowa City by rail, arriving June 9th. The cart and wagon train company departed June 13th. 330 Mormons and their converts walking, a few riding, 1,300 miles to Salt Lake City, arriving September 13th, 1837, led by Christensen. Six died. The truth may have been different, for what is truth? Who tells the tale? If you are a Mormon, you have your Mormon truth. If not, the tale is different. Victims have justification. What was done to them? Mormons have their persecution, future redemption. Anyway, this continues with the Mormon Trail, takes them over the Rockies to the desert, and then moves from there to various settlements. Remember, this is 1857, the time of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. The entire religion is violent, immersed in polygamy. Brigham Young had 40 wives, I think. Joseph Smith was even worse. He had 50, and he concealed most of it. Bringing it up much later. I think a little history is in order. In 1841, in Hans Mill, there was a massacre of Mormons, and they had to move from there to Nauvoo in Illinois. They formed another settlement. In 1843, Joseph Smith revealed revelation about polygamy, although before then he had acquired a couple of other wives. All of a sudden he declared it legal. They left Nauvoo after a lot of fighting in Carthage, and went across, found Salt Lake City in 1847. And then in 57 was the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the same year that my ancestors arrived in Gunnison. Basically, the violence, the fundamentalism persists and leads into they have a sense of persecution. You're taught this as a kid. And I think old summer school. Sunday school. Mormons exist in a parallel universe, like ours, but just oddly displaced. Like physicists, other dimension brains and strings we cannot perceive. We are not taught the Bible in Sunday school while the elders sat in the big hall, confessing their sins and redemptions within a judging silence. We were not given Solomon's sensuous songs, not the loves of Rachel and Leah, Job's mystery, misery, raging at God. We were taught the Book of Mormon instead. The tale of the golden plates recovered from the hill of Ramah, where all the Lamanites and Nephites fell, taken over by Satan's will, dying all, leaving the land to the savages, dyed red because of their sins and lack of repentance and acceptance of Christ. Oh, on polygamy. On the hive wall, the message bee dances. Inside, the sweet hum of women working, feeding the she, the state, the church. The hum of reproduction droning away, preaching in a tabernacle hive, to overwhelming togetherness, enlisted in the common task. No one should be alone. This, the heart's protection, a hive enclosing a pyramid of progeny where none should be alone. Are worker bees happy, committed to feeding the pyramid, her swelling, forever swelling figure above a pyramid, elders at the top, babies, all new workers below? Feathers. I saw deceased children thrown. Excuse me. I saw diseased chickens thrown alive to be devoured by the hogs walking. Grunt stopped. I grew up on concrete streets, never knew such muck or the old rhythms of life, the smell of it. Replaced by exhaust sifting in the sea fog. Do I dare to understand was not perceived on the farm to be something understood? It was, is, will be the daily chore. I was sent to school to not know of my roots in such a future, the stench of it, the feathers flying. How could I write about the settlers? Not easily. No memory of their daily muscle strain, their work endless, their joys few, then coition and babies new. Instruction. This is something an adolescent boy runs into. After a long apocryphic injunction, meandering recitation of necessary beliefs, the bishop's chore before a boy's elevation, the Mormon Aaronic priesthood demands instruction. Before a boy's prick hardens to find wet night pleasures, the bishop declares a sin. Do you masturbate? A man would confess. Do you masturbate, sin in the face of God? Does a boy then lie? If he doesn't, he's lost. If he doesn't have to, he's lost. Becoming them, one of them. Gates open, gates clash shut. Breaking the Wonder Bread. The little Mormon priests do it in the church kitchen, dicing and chopping into little cubes, white Wonder Bread, eating some of it. Fooling around, flying crusts at each other, and filled little cups with water, while testimonials drone on in the meeting hall. This kind of sacrament is no longer one person at a time advancing to the rail to address their Lord, whatever it might be, in solemn privacy to affirm their connection, but a whole mass sitting on hard benches, taking the little Wonder Bread cubes and little cups of water from trays passed hand to hand. All partake, all must, some monitor everyone else. Dry. Bleak, dry sawn wood, desert bleached and brittle on swinging screen doors, tumbleweed sweeping by relentless, sticks hard to metal, scratching screen doors. The houses that huddled there can be seen from infinity. Their poverty seemed plain, swept by the furnace of day, like the dehydrated roots of toppled trees, root arms writhing and sky-reaching, skulls of the long dead white. The evidence of everything is there. The tracks of being never perish. The desert holds forever memories of pioneers, migrant-seeking work, endless tracks and dehydrated lives. Love vanishes in the impossibility of life in eternally arid plains. It's so clear, so still, baking in the heat. We wish hell would break loose, scour the ridges with lightning, dust devils twisting in the valleys, darkness descending from above. Unless the raging jet stream, our vast storm walls change the light paths going east to west or west to east over the blank interior landscape, checkerboard monotony giving way to mountains and vast arid spaces. I never pass over the homestead I look for, the sparse cluster of dots, circular patches of green between brown, jagged, upthrust masses. Gray tan emptiness all around, scratched occasionally by road tracks and arrow straight rails. You see the distances like yardsticks, measure maps, don't feel them. Hours between the places I drove through in 68. Since then I've looked down from constellations, DC-6s, 747s, all the birds going from coast to coast, flying over far above the memories that fade away, becoming mere dots and dashes and pale green circles eventually. An envoy finished the book. This place revered is beautiful. It's a space that goes on and on into the blue of distant mountains, where the sky unframed is infinite. And so it is like ocean, infinite, a bowl of dry existence and light. The rage of storms seems elsewhere, though plain to see, rain cloud shadows marching like Dorian columns over the plain rarely come near. Abundant, towering, glowing with lightning strikes. Blue sky above the black, sunset slashes red, pink into the white cloud tops all dark below. It's not an easy place, this desert landscape, harsh, but it lives. Every creature has found a way, moves or adapts follows the water. The Indians know the rhythm, left monuments to changes, Chaco Canyon, Canyon de Che, Monteverde, rituals, kivas, and brotherhood, never isolation. But now shattered, white men came, disease followed. The clue to survival is love, the large love of in gathering, of sharing, each for all for each, the self-sufficient wither. Somehow the Mormon knows this. It was there at the beginning, in the confusion of the Great Awakening, a nation of aimless individual settlers and owners, driven by land greed, bouncing off each other, nuclear families trying for position as we do now, started to coalesce. Stepping beyond logic, letting belief work, inspired by ideas of God, they had revelations, new truths, nuclei attracting the needy. A golden book revealed by Angel Moroni to guide them to a spiritual home. The Mormons had to flee greed's corrosion and found the highest desert lands, their Pueblo place, their tribal home. Even black holes spit out matter. There will be those who cannot believe, spin-offs, the casualties of togetherness, cursed by being neither in or out. The Mormons were not quite right, but were they totally wrong? We need something from them. Move more than their cleanliness or politeness, like the spirit that helped them walk 1,300 miles, facing adversity together, as we must climate change. We need the idea of common sister brotherhood, beyond self-sufficiency, beyond our mythic progress, the isolations of technology, the cruelty of the markets. What gods there are within us. Our only savior must be ourselves. Mormons hope for their own salvation, for their family, but not for all, not for those outside. We haven't accepted their faith, haven't been included in their wide mesh of souls. They know we will be left behind. The handshake engraved on their temple is for them, their pass into heaven at the end. No matter how bad it can get, reach out, step away from yourself, shake every hand, stand in a circle, be one, together, be in love. I have a hope, a dream of an open world. I'm now far from the desert bleakness, sitting at the edge of a great salt marsh, alive with egrets, errant gulls, a sea breeze, little boats coming in, end of the day, an osprey crying chirps over wooded island, children splashing in the shadows. In this, my green, flowered, moist home in Essex. There is no need to hold absolute truths. The weather changes. The main body of the book chronicles how they traveled from Omaha across the mountains, how they settled, how my great-grandfather died, how the property was taken, put into the to Brigham Young's Common Order, how my grandfather left and herded sheep, eventually built his house, and then the house that I burned down. Maybe I will actually read that short section and then call it quits. The fire. Mid-July, 1938, hot and dry, as high mountain valleys are hot. Nothing much is happening. The hay is in. Irrigation's done at night, cows milked and taken out to pasture, eggs collected, our chose done. I was 10, my brother 7. Our cousin Robert 8. We played with matches. Central Utah valleys are dry. The churches are Mormon. The settlers dry and tough, mostly Mormon, except for Grandfather Chris. Never knew what he was. We knew what he was not. But his big Victorian house with his large front lawn confronted the old adobe Mormon church across the main road into town. We'd seen pictures from Spain of Franco's airplanes bombing the socialists, whatever they were, and of Fokker triplane Spads dogfighting over France and Germany. We saw the smoke trails crossing the skies over trenches in the smoke trails of the matches we threw flaming out of the second floor window. Imagine gleefully until this box was empty, we ran downstairs outside to find another game to play. Of course, the empty box was found by my mother, who knew, always knew what's forbidden. We did not escape the angry censure we feared. All summer days are long and slow. We had horses to ride, inflated inner tubes to ride the currents in the irrigation canals. Days later, at noon dinner, crashing in the back door, a neighbor came crying, "Fire, fire, the house is on fire." All the neighbors, all the towns came rushing in. Everything in the house was taken out. Even the laden table with slices of watermelon was placed in the lawn as if we ate outside. Fire hoses were useless. The hydrant in front failed, and the fire relentlessly and slowly ate the house. Pitiless are the children watching the spectacle, flames and dancing motions of salvaging men. All my grandparents' things arrayed on the lawns, and the munitions in the attic going off. Feeble water from garden hoses was useless, could not stop the conflagration. It only cooled the ashes and adobe bricks. It was mid-July, hot. There were no breaks, only rain and thunder in the mountains. We moved to my uncle's cellar house and lived in a dark closet, black ash on our hands, in my nostrils day after day, while we cleaned blackened bricks of mortar with wet ash clinging for the rest of the summer. No more riding, no more floating. No one said we did anything wrong. The insurance adjuster assessed the embers, fallen bricks, strands of wires, rusted blackened hinges, concluding faulty wiring on the porch caused the fire in the eaves below the window, and validated the claim to rebuild the house with the bricks from the acrid, dark ruin. But we knew why as we cleaned the bricks better than they and swallowed our knowing. We baked in the house furnace of guilt. My cousin eventually went mad. This house was his nursery, his soul place, grandparents closer and warmer than his own. We went home to the city at Labor Day. We're never asked back by our embittered grandfather. My mother lost her husband, free summers, and the heat that dried her fog-drenched bones. Towns in the desert, forlorn, wooden, bleached gray, endure. No moisture, ravenous ants consume the tall, flat storefronts. Wind and the brittle age cut them down. Driving east through Nevada and Utah, back to my mother's beginning place, going on empty roads, infinity ahead as the road thins into a line, the vanishing point never reached in the hills before me. There ahead, a brown town, our core, the remnants, our fragments of history laid out plain. Seen from far away, It sprawled across the freeway, with the old adobe Mormon church on one side, the brick rebuild of a great Victorian grand house on the other. Unlike the old countries, the settlers came home. This land is not yet drenched in blood. It's uncared for, not sacred, to be owned and used. This land was for taking what you can get. It is now as it was at the beginning, flat valleys ringed by mountains and brown roasted hills. But now sugar beets fill the flat, and the beet factory's sugar sweet stench obliterates the old sense of sage. I found all my uncle's family still in Centerfield. Mont finally finished his house on its cellar hole foundation, the sunken home I remember living in after the fire. My grandfather, Chris Sorensen, alone in the brick house, didn't want to see me. I didn't say. Saw everyone, drove east, never went back. Doors shut behind us, hard to open later, become as bronze, mythic doors. Thank you. More?
What was the Mormon War? Was that
the Mormon War? It was 1857, same time the Mountain Massacre. But the U.S. government had sent some troops. And so they were organized militias. And obviously they had the experience just 10 years before of being attacked in Nauvoo. And then they negotiated a way out. And that's when they left. They had been massacred in other places. So deep within them is this fear of being prosecuted. But they kind of brought it on by themselves by being so exclusive and by denying everybody else, which I think is a characteristic they still have. I know in my own family I have cousins in Oregon that, well, they owe me a painting. It's a complicated story. But they can't give it up because it might have value. And of course, they have lots of children, huge clans. And that when I finished all of this, I finally decided I'd look up ex-Mormons. So I just looked up on the website. And lo and behold, there's an ex-Mormon foundation. And you find recovery. Recovery, really recovery room like Al-Anon for people who have gotten out of the cults. And it is cult-like in its grab and hold on you. There's an element of paranoia in the people who have broken from the church. They feel they're coming after you. And I think its part comes from the inherent violence of fundamentalism, of the adherence to the cult. And I had these feelings too. I have this sort of anxiety when people in black suits turn up. But half the time they're the FBI, and that's another whole story.
Another cult.
Another cult, right. But there is a huge literature, and if you want to read a good book on the violent, the wars and so on, it's John Krakauer's
book. Thanks so much, Ken.
Book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Krakauer's book is under the banner of heaven. John Krakauer really describes beautifully the elements of violence in the Mormon, both the fundamentalists, the existing polygamists and so on.
You said you equated the elements of violence with persecution.
Well, yeah.
It was a result of persecution?
Well, it's funny. If you are a prophet and you're... The Book of Mormon contains all imitations of all the violence that's in the Bible.
I see.
And so they believe you smite the bad guy. There's a division of good and bad. You're good, they're bad. Mm. So inherently there's this exclusion that can have a violent edge to it. Mm. And then people react to that. So you get recurrent flows of violence back and forth. Mm. And then this leads to the feeling that you have to collect yourself into a coherent group because you're besieged from outside. Mm-hmm. And they decided they were chosen people. And the whole thing about the Book of Mormon is that the is supposed to be the 13th tribe of Israel. Mm-hmm. And the Lord took them, had them build a boat, and he sent them across the ocean. And they ended up in South America. And then it's a long tale, which I can't untangle. I can't even remember the silly thing, although I did read it as a kid, and I've looked at it since then. But it seems to be full of people smiting people, the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. And they have, huh? The non-Mormons. They also have a belief that they're akin to God, that they, once you're an elder, you have the right to sit on the right side of God when you die. And the attitude is Jesus and man can acquire the status of equality with God. So the elders...
The United States take over Utah and make it a state.
They took it over in, well, obviously, as soon as they accessed the whole area, and that, I think, well, that actually was around 1857.
Oh, that early?
Yeah, and that's when the Mormon War began.
I thought that they took it over much later as part of a state.
Well, yeah, they made it a state, but...
In the 80s.
Yeah, that was the 80s. Yeah.